I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Bruce Barcott. He's author of the new book, Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. He's a longtime contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So this is a book about marijuana and the movements toward legalization in this country. The cultural shift that's going on in this country with respect to the legalization of pot is huge. But it's really important to know, as you write about in the book, about the shift on the other end. Around the turn of the last century, marijuana really wasn't even an issue. Then it came to be reviled and prohibited and classified with the most dangerous drugs like heroin. What happened?
Well, what happened was the federal government got a hold of marijuana and really blew it up into an issue and a drug that it sort of portrayed the drug as something that was far, far more dangerous than it actually is. The federal government outlawed it in 1937 and sort of has continued to treat it as this demon weed, this substance that they consider as dangerous as heroin, cocaine, any of your most deadly drugs. But, you know, and that has continued to this day. But I think that what's going on right now is a combination of a couple of things. You know, people ask me, why is legalization happening now? And one thing is, we have much more information now than we did 20 or 30 years ago. We have this thing called the Internet that gives us access to sort of a counter-narrative, and it allows us to actually go in and look at the research that's been done on marijuana and decide for ourselves. The second part is that we really have had 20 years of a pilot project, 20 years of experience with medical marijuana now in 23 states. And, you know, we've rolled out these dispensaries. Marijuana has been sold sort of in the gray market area of medical marijuana. And the walls of society have held. You know, we haven't seen a spike in crime or addiction rates. And so I think a lot of people's worst fears have been put to bed.
There was a fellow named Harry Anslinger who was a very vociferous and successful anti-marijuana crusader.
Yeah, he was.
And his story is really an illustration of the reality that one person on a crusade can engender a situation where generations of people are sure, they're positive, that they know something that turns out to be pure propaganda.
Yeah, it's true. Anslinger was really the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs. He was the first, essentially the first drug czar in the federal government. And when he came in and decided that marijuana was going to be sort of priority number one, he started this crusade that involved essentially going around the country and speaking to civic groups. He would bring with him this notebook full of newspaper clippings that he himself would foment these news stories about, you know, criminal activity being connected to marijuana and crazy murderous acts and the debauchery of women connected to the demon weed. And he would go around and essentially, you know, give stump speeches against marijuana around the nation. The other thing that he was able to do was essentially control the flow of information. Anybody who said something that was counter to Anslinger's line was either knocked back or he actually came out and said that, you know, he would arrest or pull the licenses of any researcher or doctor who conducted research on marijuana without his permission. And so he really had control over the entire flow of information. And that was the way these laws sort of kept getting ratcheted up, was people in Congress would listen to Anslinger. Anslinger would go in and say, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. And the people in Congress had no idea. They had no experience with it, and they had really nobody to come in and say, you know, actually, I've done some work on this, and it's not as bad as Harry says.
I mean, it's really a cautionary tale that should remind us to examine the things that we think we know for sure today. And it turns out that, I mean, scientific study after scientific study conducted over the course of the 20th century demonstrate that marijuana use is, you know, really not problematic. And yet, first of all, politicians listen to people like Anslinger, and they then reject, even the politicians who asked for the study, reject or bury these reports.
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, I really did a deep dive into the history of marijuana in America for this book and kind of condensed it all into one tight chapter. But what struck me was the fact that, you know, every 20 years or so, the federal government would actually commission a study on marijuana and say, hey, look, what's the scope of the problem here? There was a study commissioned in the 1940s. There was a study commissioned in the 70s. There was a study commissioned in the 90s. And each of those studies came back. You know, originally the studies were really kind of packed with both conservatives and medical authorities. And each of those studies came back and said, you know, look, marijuana is not a safe drug. No drug is safe. But it's really not as dangerous as it's being made out to be. I mean, in the early 70s, that study came back and actually recommended that we decriminalize marijuana. But the people in power, you know, at the time it was Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon was like, well, no to that. You know, that's not going to happen on my watch. Basically, it's just for purely political reasons, because from Nixon's point of view, the people who were in favor of or using marijuana were liberals and, in his words, the long hairs, you know, and he was against that.
Yeah, I mean, it really had nothing to do with the nature of the drug itself, but rather the culture.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, there's a sort of give and take on the culture of the 60s that's involved in this. You know, the baby boomers in the 60s were the ones who really brought marijuana into mainstream culture. You know, before that, it was really a jazz drug, a drug of the beatniks and this sort of thing. Very small, tiny portion of the population using it. So the baby boomers brought it forth. At the same time, you know, they kind of mainstreamed it. But then because it became so associated with alternative culture, with hippie culture, this sort of thing, it became more difficult for those reasonable voices to break through and say, hey, look, just disregard the whole hippie thing. Whatever you think of that culture, this drug, you know, scientifically should be treated, you know, really more like alcohol than any other really dangerous drug. And that was a problem.
The culture that you're talking about that arose in the 60s then morphed into contemporary stoner culture, which usually seems to involve the Grateful Dead,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, white people with dreadlocks, tie-dye, patchouli oil.
Right.
But there were some references in your book to people using marijuana in the early and mid-20th century. There's just a line about how you had something like, you have a soft spot for the Manhattan tea pads of the 1940s.
Yeah, you know, there was a study commissioned by Mayor LaGuardia of New York in the late 30s, and he basically asked a local medical establishment to look into marijuana, and it took a number of years and commissioned all sorts of studies. And one of the things they did was they looked at how marijuana was being used among adults in New York, and they had essentially these marijuana speakeasies. They called them tea pads. And the researchers would go to these tea pads, and they would sort of hang out and record what they were watching. And, you know, there's one report where they go up to a tea pad in Harlem, and it's essentially set up on a rooftop in Harlem, and they have these little tents there, and people would go and smoked a joint in the tent. And then the researcher said they would all emerge and come out and look at the beautiful blue sky and remark upon the stars. And that was it. Like, there was no grand orgy or debauchery or violence after that. It was essentially, that was the end of the report, was they all came out and remarked upon the beauty of the stars.
Amazing. There was a moment of hope for legalization advocates under President Jimmy Carter, and it fell apart. What happened?
Yeah. You know, Carter came in, and he actually had made a campaign promise that he was going to push for decriminalization of marijuana after the whole morass of the Nixon years. And then, you know, then he got into office, and he kind of got cold feet. He started to worry about the signal that decriminalization would send to kids, and all the classic fears arose. He had a drug advisor, Peter Bourne, who was a really smart guy and was really pushing for decriminalization and was really the advocate for this act. And the problem was that essentially Bourne got caught up in a scandal and essentially lost his job. The scandal was he made the poor choice of deciding to show up at the Christmas party that NORML, the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, was throwing in Washington, D.C. And normal parties in the 70s were sort of epic. I mean, they were quite a thing. And if you were a, you know, an advisor in the White House, you really did not want to show up at a normal party. But he did. And a scandal broke a few months later where Jack Anderson, you know, the great muckraking columnist, broke a story on Good Morning America that Jimmy Carter's drug advisor had been seen at the normal party. And it was reported that he had used drugs there. Bourne, to this day, says, no, look, I was there at the party. I didn't use anything. But just the idea that he was there and he showed up, well, his resignation was on the president's desk the next day. And decriminalization sort of really, really kind of died that day.
We're talking to Bruce Barcott, author of Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. After Jimmy Carter, of course, we had Reagan, the war on drugs, and that's a story many of us are familiar with. People in prison for possession of small amounts of marijuana, the millions and billions of dollars wasted, the complete non-effect on actual use of the drug, the racial disparity. Was there anything in this research that you did on the war on drugs since 1981 that surprised you?
I think what surprised me was the, the slow and inexorable way that racial disparities in arrest rates and incarceration rates just continued to rise and grow, and that gap between essentially white and black folks really just grew and grew and grew until some people started to you know, try to call our attention to it and say, look, this is ridiculous. You know, we have a gap in terms of arrest rates where a person of color is four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana than a white person across the board in America. And, you know, the usage rates for people of color and white people are essentially the same. It's about, you know, 11-12% among adults. It's actually that arrest rate is much worse in some municipalities. I mean, it's sometimes as much as 8 or 10 times as likely in some places. So that's one of the things that really is, for me, one of the engines driving this pushback against marijuana laws and for legalization, is that this is an aspect of the drug war that has really gotten out of hand, and I think legalization is one solid step toward reining it in and reforming it.
How did you yourself get involved with this whole issue and come to write the book?
I was faced with a ballot. You know, we voted on legalization here in Washington State back in November of 2012. Prior to that, I didn't give pot much thought. You know, I hadn't really used it since college. When we looked at the ballot, I had real fears about my kids and whether they would have greater access to it. And honestly, you know, I told my wife, you know, I just don't want to smell the pot. I don't want to have to smell it more often than I do now. In the end, though, I talked to a friend. She argued with me and pointed out the war on drugs and the racial disparities, and I thought she had a fair point. So I held my nose. I voted yes. And the next morning, I woke up and found we had, in fact, legalized marijuana. And I wondered, what in the world did we just do? And that was kind of the start of the book. I realized, it's like, you know what, my background is as a science journalist, and I really have no dog in the hunt in terms of being pro or anti-marijuana. But what I can do here is really dive into this, try to figure out what's going on with pot, you know, medically, scientifically, historically, and then basically report to the rest of the country and say, look, this is how it's going. You know, we're 2 years into a fully legal state here, and this is what it's like to live under legalization.
It's interesting because you write about the process of legalization in Colorado and in your home state of Washington, mm-hmm. and it's not really a super smooth process. And it's also interesting because the two states are setting quite different rules. What did the early days of legalization look like in each state?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, when I go and talk about the book now, especially in Washington and in Colorado, I always get questions from people in the audience that are like, why is this, why do we have these crummy laws, right, here in our state? And the answer is, in Colorado and Washington, the price we pay for being pioneers is we have the beta version of these laws. You know, yeah. I think 1.0 and 2.0 are coming down the road, but our laws are the rough draft. Nobody's ever done this before. So we're inventing these laws from whole cloth, and, you know, they're not perfect. Colorado's system is going much better than ours is here in Washington State, and the main reason is they chose to regulate their medical marijuana system years before voting in full adult use. And so they had an entire system set up with regulation, with taxation. They tracked the product from seed to sale. And so the first people who got the licenses to sell adult retail pot were already in the medical marijuana business. They were known good actors. They knew how to work with regulators and to do it right. In Washington State, on the other hand, we essentially had never regulated our medical system, and so we offered licenses to anybody and everybody. We basically pulled winners in through a lottery system. And the problem was, that's fairness. We like fairness a lot out here in Washington State. It's fair, but that resulted in a lot of people winning licenses who had no experience with pot, no experience operating a business, and no chance at raising the funds it takes to open an actual pot shop. So our system out here in Washington State is sort of creaky and slow, whereas in Colorado, they're doing much better than we are.
One thing that's going on, of course, because there's so much money involved, is capitalists are getting into the game. And yet there's this fascinating chapter where you write about how investors are hungrily eyeing this market, but nobody really wants to be the first in the game.
Yeah, you know, it's still a very risky investment. I mean, there are a few very sophisticated investors working in this space. They have backgrounds on Wall Street and Silicon Valley. But for most folks, you know, these are investments that happen at the $20,000 level, $30,000 level. You know, and I've read a number of investor prospectuses, you know, that come out and basically tell you what the business is, how to invest, and by law then they have to reveal all the risks that are involved. You know, and when they lay out all the risks, they say, you know, we could lose all the money. The feds could shut us down tomorrow. We could be arrested by the DEA. You could be implicated in some sort of drug scheme. These are not normal investor risks that people often consider. And then beyond that, you know, there are a lot of businesses that aren't going to make it in this industry. I mean, people generally assume that legalizing marijuana and then getting a license to sell, you know, is essentially a license to print money. And that's not the case at all. This is a tough business. It's just like any other small business. A lot of people are going to fail.
There was one set of really interesting sort of savvy investors who basically said, oh, there's a gold rush. This is a good time to get into the pick and shovel business.
Yes, exactly.
You know, ancillary industries.
Yeah, ancillary industries are, if I had money to invest, and I'm a writer, so I don't, but if I did, I really would look at those ancillary businesses. You know, everything from business insurance to packaging to security systems and this sort of thing. I mean, I met one of my favorite characters in the book is a guy named Ross Kirsch. And Ross is not a weed head. He's not a big pot smoker. He doesn't want to grow it. He doesn't want to sell it. What he wants to do is package it. Ross is sort of the wunderkind of packaging. And he realized that with pot, you needed two things. You needed some sort of material that would block the smell, because pot, raw pot, is incredibly fragrant. I mean, it really, really stinks up a car or a house or a room. And the second thing he needed was some sort of child-resistant closure, because state laws are really tough. They would say, we do not want kids getting into this stuff. So Ross essentially designed a kind of, Ziploc bag that had a child-resistant zipper system on it. Went over to China, started manufacturing them over there, shipping them over here. And, you know, at a certain point in the book, I ended up running back into Ross as he was literally wheeling pallets of these packages into pot shops in Denver.
Yeah, there's this whole crazy business that banks don't want to deal with pot businesses. They don't want to take the money. And so people are putting money into like bank vaults, and then it smells up the bank vaults, and a banker says, "Oh, you've got to, you have to wash your money before you bring it in," which of course makes you think about money laundering, literal money laundering.
Right, exactly, exactly. No, the banking situation is really tough. It's a bad deal. You know, we do not want all this cash floating out there. It's really, if there is a crime attractant, that's the problem with marijuana in the industry right now. It's that there is this cash out there, and these store owners and growers need to figure out how to handle it safely. I mean, a lot of people try to deal with it by settling up with their vendors like daily. You know, they'll usually you send an invoice and it's you got 30 to 60 days to pay. Well, they'll pay in a day or two because they've got to keep that money moving out of the shop. And you know, and there are other people who have invested simply in massive old style bank vaults that are bolted to the floor, you know, and they'll keep their money in there. So there are a lot of creative ways to get around it, but really the federal government needs to figure out some way to deal with the situation and allow banks to simply handle this money.
We're talking to Bruce Barcott about his book, Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. Now, how has legalization affected organized crime, drug cartels, which used to be basically the monopoly provider of illegal drugs of all kinds?
Yeah, that's one of the main arguments for legalization is we take it out of the hands of the drug cartels, put it in the hands of legitimate business people, and have the state regulate it. And for the most part, that is happening. I know here in Washington State, a couple things are going on. Number one, we used to have a real, real problem with illegal marijuana grows, mostly financed and run by drug cartels, happening on federal land, in national forests, national parks, this sort of thing. They're hugely destructive and very dangerous for anybody who came across them. Well, over the last few years, the number of those drug grows that the sort of law enforcement task force has discovered has plunged by about 90%. I mean, they just aren't finding them anymore. There's no market out here in the Northwest to take that pot. The other thing that's going on is that there have been reports, and the Washington Post has done a really good job on covering this, reports on medical cartels down in Mexico stopping the planting of marijuana. Now, unfortunately, they're essentially the mafia, so they now plant other things. They'll plant, you know, poppies for heroin, and they're ramping up, you know, their business in sex trafficking and this sort of thing. So we can't, you know, it's not a panacea, but at least the marijuana market is drying up. And it's partly drying up because their product is crummy. You know, I mean, people joke about Mexican brickweed, but it's lousy stuff. And there's really no reason to buy it when you can go into a legal shop and buy some of the finest marijuana ever grown anywhere in the world. And it's really not that much more expensive than what, you know, the guy in the corner is selling it for.
Marijuana is available to anybody to buy in Colorado and Washington. Many other states have medical marijuana programs. Has the existence of these medical marijuana programs shifted the perception of marijuana in general?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that we would not have full adult use marijuana legalization without medical marijuana. I think that, you know, medical marijuana started back in 1996 in California, and it's rolled out, I think, you know, in 23 states and D.C. now. And what medical marijuana did was, you know, it showed that this product actually had some legitimate medicinal use. I mean, there are a lot of people who have problems with it, and it's in terms of the way it's handled, and you know, it's not gone through any sort of FDA system. But you know, look, there are actual people gaining benefits from this. People who have epilepsy, who have PTSD, who are dealing with chronic pain, and because of that medical marijuana system, I think then more and more people saw marijuana being handled fairly reasonably in their community. There weren't a lot of problems that came out about or because of the dispensaries, and people were sort of like, we kind of already have marijuana in our community now, and it doesn't seem to be that big of a problem, so let's take that, you know, the next half step and try full legalization.
What is the state of scientific research into the benefits and hazards of marijuana here in the U.S.?
that was one of the most interesting parts of the book for me, was looking into what research actually was out there. And here's the deal is with medical research, that essentially whenever you're dealing with a drug like marijuana or cocaine or heroin, anything like this, you have to get permission from the federal government to study that drug. And really, for most of the past half century, the federal government has allowed studies of marijuana that are likely to show harm and has disallowed studies that are likely to show health benefits or healing benefits. The federal agencies like NIDA and others will say it's not so. But really, if you talk to anybody who's actually done research in this area, it's sort of a joke. It's really known that if you want to study medical marijuana, you're likely to wait for years for approval or just get turned down outright. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on with the healing aspect of marijuana that's happening outside the U.S. Some of the best studies are actually being done in Israel, in Canada, in the U.K., in Spain. And so that's where we're getting a lot of interesting reports on epilepsy, on cancer, on PTSD, this sort of thing. At the same time, you know, there is some really interesting research also going on in terms of the harm, and especially the harm to young people. We're coming to know much more about the developing brain and how sort of the wiring in the brain goes through a sort of finishing phase during adolescence and late adolescence. And, you know, if you flood your brain with these cannabinoids from marijuana, it can really mess with that final wiring. And for a small percentage of the population who is sort of genetically predisposed to schizophrenia, marijuana smoking can be just an absolute disaster. It can be like kryptonite for those folks. So it's really, I think this goes back to my role, not just as a writer, but as a parent. You know, I've got two young teenagers, and I'm writing this book about pots. So I really wanted to be able to talk with them from a scientific basis, you know, using facts and saying, look, this is why I really don't want you touching this stuff. If you're going to try it, wait till your early 20s, but really don't touch it right now.
You yourself found that there was a cream, a marijuana cream, that helped your knee pain.
Yeah.
And apparently ballet dancers are using it all the time.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, this was one of the first ways in which I was using, you know, medical marijuana was I started doing some research into the industry, and I found some folks who were producing this topical cream infused with THC and other cannabinoids, and I found, some of the principal dancers at Pacific Northwest Ballet up here in Seattle were using this because they've really got to watch their intake of aspirin and Advil and stuff like this, just like, you know, any professional athlete would. But they found that it really helped with joint pain and inflammation. And so I tried it on my knee. I've got kind of some creaky knees, and I do a lot of skating and that sort of thing. And I found that it really helped. So I've been sort of using it ever since, and I've introduced some other friends to it as well, and they like it. So there's this sort of a vast array of new products and new ways that marijuana is being used today that most people just aren't aware of.
There is a marijuana component which is not THC, which is called, I believe, CBD,
right,
which has no psychoactive properties. And there was a researcher you describe in your book who was trying for years and years and years to get permission to study it. And one of the problems, besides the reluctance to study the health benefits of marijuana, is that the one lab in the whole country that actually grows this stuff is growing the sort of most primitive, unsophisticated strains of it, and they don't even have the high CBD, low THC strains.
Right. It's funny that, you know, one of the questions I ask people at my readings, I'm just curious to see who knows this. I say, where do you think the nation's supply of research marijuana is grown? And the answer is the University of Mississippi. It's grown at Ole Miss. It's been grown there for years. It's basically the nation's federal pot farm, and they're on contract with NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and they have for years grown just notoriously lousy pot. I mean, it's been low THC, low quality for it seems seems like forever. Meanwhile, you know, the nation's real supply of pot, whether it's black market or gray market or medical marijuana, has slowly been climbing in both THC levels, so it's basically at about, you know, 18 to 24% now, and research pot has been, you know, 4 to 7% for years. And this new strain or these new strains of high CBD pot are also being cultivated. And for, you know, for the longest time, the feds simply didn't have it. And the researcher you're mentioning is Sue Sisley. She's been trying to get a research study on PTSD and high CBD pot in the works for years. And she's one of the people that has really pushed them to open up the variety that they grow and cultivate there. It's funny, the pot farm just this month, about 2 weeks ago, released its first new catalog of higher THC pot and higher CBD pot. It was a real kind of a breakthrough and surprised a lot of folks, but the feds do seem to be actually opening up a little bit in terms of considering studies that look into the healing aspect and providing you know, a better grade and a wider variety of marijuana.
But meanwhile, this wonderful researcher whom you mentioned was fired from her job.
Yeah, she was fired. I mean, that's one of the risks that people still run. I mean, she was at the University of Arizona, and she's a psychiatrist down there doing research, and essentially got in trouble when the state legislature heard that she was interested in doing this pot research. You know, never mind the fact that it's being done on, you know, veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war who are suffering from PTSD. They're using pot to try to contain their symptoms and really are sort of desperate to know whether, you know, pot is actually doing them any good medically or, you know, what they should be using, why or why not. That's what she really wants to study. But, you know, because it's pot, people in the legislature sort of lashed out at her and threatened the university's funding because of it, and she was essentially fired because of that.
What is the relationship between marijuana and cancer?
This is an interesting one. First of all, marijuana has been used by cancer patients for decades to control nausea and to keep down food or to stimulate the appetite. It's funny, I worked on this book and ran into a number of veteran nurses, oncology nurses, who would say, you know, this medical marijuana is people think it's new, but we knew this back in the 70s, you know, when we had cancer patients who would undergo chemotherapy. And then afterwards, they basically, you know, if they wanted to and could find a way to obtain it, you know, they would smoke a joint in their hospital room, and we would sort of just discreetly close the door and stand watch while they did it next to an open window. And we knew this was going on, and we knew the actual positive effects it had for those patients. So that's been going on for years. The really interesting cutting-edge research that's going on now is looking into whether components of marijuana, THC, CBD, and others, can actually have sort of an anti-tumor effect on certain types of cancer. Now, I want to say this is not to say that smoking pot cures cancer. No, that's not it at all. But there are interesting studies being done, especially by a fellow named Manuel Guzman over in Spain, on the effects of THC on a certain type of brain cancer called glioblastoma. That's a really difficult cancer to cure. It doesn't respond well to much treatment. But what he's been doing over there is really cutting edge. It shows some signs of potential, and that's the kind of research I think we need to encourage and allow more of in this country. But it's not being done because it's just so difficult to work with marijuana.
We're talking to Bruce Barcott about his book, Weed the People. Is marijuana addictive?
For some people, it can be. This is a hugely controversial question within marijuana circles. There are a lot of people who will argue that marijuana is in no way addictive. And that this is one of those questions where this is like my background as a science reporter comes out, and I'm like, okay, look, what's the real deal here? Is it addictive or not? And I found a guy, actually he's based here in Seattle, Roger Rothman, who's was at the University of Washington for decades, and he studied for most of that time. He studied marijuana and marijuana addiction. And I said, Roger, look, what did you find? And he said, really, it's about 7 to 8% of people who use marijuana, they really do develop a type of dependency. It's not the kind of addiction that is like a heroin addiction where you go out and start stealing things to support the addiction, but it really it harms your life. Your relationships are harmed, your work life is harmed, this sort of thing, and it takes some effort to get off it or to dial back from your marijuana use. So that's it's definitely out there, and I think we, like Roger said, we really have to face that head on. At the same time, Roger Rothman was one of the primary sponsors of the legalization initiative in Washington State. So his message is, look, I think we do need to legalize and regulate this, but we need to do it while going in with our eyes open.
It's funny. I mean, you can't overdose on it. At least there have been no cases of overdose that we know of.
Right.
The impact on driving seems to be that you drive slower, or it doesn't seem to have any impact on driving. But there were two deaths in Colorado, both associated with edible marijuana. What happened?
Yeah, edibles have been and are an early problem, an early bump in the road. And the deal is, when we have full adult use retail pot now, there are a lot of people who are coming to it for the first time or are coming back to it after, having not used any marijuana for many years. And, smoking in general for a lot of people is not a pleasant experience. So they will often try an edible. And the problem with edibles is that everybody's body reacts so differently to an edible. And there's this time lag where if you eat a brownie right now, it may kick in after 10 minutes or it may not kick in for a full hour. And if you're one of those people for whom it doesn't kick in for a full hour, after 20 minutes, you're looking around and saying, oh, my God, this is not affecting me at all. Give me that second brownie. I'm gonna try that second brownie. An hour later, both brownies are kicking in and you're in for a bad trip. It's a wild ride. It's not good. And so for those two people, we had one college student who had just ate too much of, an edible cookie and sort of had basically your old-fashioned freak-out night, and he fell off the balcony of the hotel he was staying in and died. The other case involved a family where the father was, I think, taking an edible and some other things along with it. And really had a psychotic reaction to it and flipped out and tragically ended up killing his wife. So when those two things happened, a lot of people in Colorado looked around and said, yee, what are we doing with edibles here? In the old days, basically we would call in a drug task force and start arresting anybody and everybody who was connected to edibles. In the legal system now, what they did was the governor appointed a task force. They had sort of emergency meetings over this, and they really ratcheted back and clamped down on the edible rules in Colorado in terms of how they were packaged, the dosage, how people talked about them when they're sold, all this sort of thing. So I think the edibles problem is coming under control, but it was one of those things where, in this new system, everybody kind of knew there was going to be some incidents here and there. There were going to be incidents here and there, but nobody was sure where they were going to happen. And it turned out this is how it was going to happen.
We're well over a year into legalization in Colorado and Washington, and there are some indicators that have changed, although the question of causality is something that we always have to be careful about. But talk about things like crime rate, tax revenue, whether we have numbers on arrests by race, racial disparity, things like that.
We have little data so far, but what data we do have generally has to do with crime rates in Denver and Seattle, or Denver and King County, which contains Seattle. Some of the most surprising data came out of Denver, which essentially said, after a year of legalization, most major crimes were down significantly. I think, homicide was down like 30%, and assault and rape were down as well. Seattle's crime rate generally held about the same. There might have been a minor uptick, but nothing significant. And that was really interesting because, it showed that, look, we legalized marijuana. There was no major crime outbreak. In fact, there was a dip in crime. But you know, honestly, you know, we can't link that causally to the legalization of pot. We can't just say, look, oh well, everybody who was a criminal just got stoned and stayed on the couch instead of going out and committing crimes, right? At the same time, it's funny though. You know that if that crime rate had risen, I think the folks against marijuana would really set off the hue and cry and say, look, we told you so. Look at the crime rate's just soaring. You know, but the crime rate really hasn't soared. We're still waiting for data to come in on usage rates and things like this. And I think that will be really interesting to see.
The politicians who are still against marijuana are starting to seem like dinosaur fossils at this point, but they're still alive and well, particularly in states like Louisiana. And you tell a very poignant story about how, you know, you can in Washington, like, go downtown and buy a joint and smoke it, but then there's Bernard Noble.
Right, right. I wanted to know, you know, if Washington and Colorado are the leading edge of marijuana reform, what is the trailing edge? You know, where are marijuana laws the worst in the U.S.? And I assumed it would be Texas or Mississippi, but no, it turned out to be Louisiana. Louisiana has a sort of wacky history having to do with marijuana. I mean, New Orleans was one of the places that marijuana first came to the U.S. through the port of New Orleans. But yeah, we have this system now in Louisiana where being busted with a joint can cost you years in prison, whereas at the same time, you know, you're welcome to stroll Bourbon Street with a full-on hurricane alcoholic beverage anytime, day or night. People had told me, look, you know, I don't think there really are people in prison for marijuana. That's ridiculous. And so I tried to find out if that was true. And in fact, you know, in Louisiana, there are plenty of people in prison for just marijuana. Bernard Noble is a guy who's my age. He's in his late 40s. He was stopped for literally bicycling while black in New Orleans in 2010. He had a couple of joints on him. They found it. He was arrested, thrown in jail. Because he had a couple of prior drug convictions, no violent crime or anything like that, he essentially got hit with a three strikes law and was sentenced to 13 years in prison. He appealed it, lost, and he is currently serving 13 years in prison in Louisiana for that same amount of marijuana that, you know, I was buying last month at Uncle Ike's shop here in Seattle.
There are many strains of marijuana that have different uses, and there are people who are at this point basically connoisseurs, as there are connoisseurs of wine. And I was wondering if a culture of marijuana is evolving among people who are more like yuppie wine drinkers than deadheads.
Possibly. You know, one of the funny things about legalizing marijuana is you can take away the laws and the legal strictures against marijuana. But the social laws, the social strictures remain. Those are very strong and powerful forces. And so, you know, the ways in which people are using marijuana here, adults using it moderately, are changing, but they're changing very slowly. We're still trying to figure out when it's okay to use it, when it's okay to offer it or to bring it out, at what kind of party or gathering. You know, there are a lot of awkward situations with pot right now among adults in these two states. There is a little bit of a connoisseurship, though, that is emerging because we now have growers competing on quality. You know, if I'm going into a pot shop in Seattle, I'm not a regular user of marijuana. I may, you know, have a joint with an adult friend maybe once every 6 months or so. So when I go in there, I really am not shopping on price. I'm interested in the absolute finest, you know, quality product that they have there, and I'm willing to spend more money for it. And I think that, you know, it's like somebody who enjoys a fine bottle of wine. They're willing to spend more to have a better experience. And that is actually, it's starting to have some effect now in the market.
The book is called Weed the People, and it's so well written. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. I tried to read it fast, and I just couldn't because the stories are so compelling, and we see you kind of walking through the first marijuana shops that you've entered and going to things like the cannabis cup. And it's, I mean, describe that. What is that?
It's funny. You know, the cannabis cup is essentially, it started out as a competition among growers of marijuana many years ago. But it really has evolved into a sort of a marijuana state fair. The Cannabis Cup last year in Denver was one of the sort of wildest, craziest shows anybody has ever seen. It took place around 420, the classic, you know, marijuana holiday last year, and essentially it was just sort of booth after booth after booth of people in the marijuana industry selling their products, selling their wares. At that point, it was still legal to offer a sample of your product for free in an enclosed private space. So at the Cannabis Cup last year, basically you had people just lining up dozens strong at booths to get a free hit of marijuana. And it was sort of an amazing, crazy scene. And in fact, this year, at this year's Cannabis Cup, that's no longer allowed. They're not allowed to give out free samples, so people will have to bring their own. But one of the things that struck me is I spent 2 days at the Cannabis Cup and with a photographer, and sort of we ended up like the two remaining sober people at the end of the day. But one of the things that struck me was, here's this gathering of people, you know, very heavily young and male in their 20s, a lot of testosterone flowing around the place. You know, if you had introduced alcohol into that scene, you would have a kind of a mess on your hands at the end of the day. But at the end of the day, at Cannabis Cup, there were a lot of people really stoned. And essentially what it did was it slowed them down. It mellowed them out. I saw no conflict. You know, people were just sort of gathering in little groups and hanging out and chatting and this sort of thing. And it was really kind of remarkable to see, you know, the effect that this drug had and compare it in your mind to the effect that alcohol might have in a similar situation. You know, I'm not saying that we should all go out and, you know, join carnivals of pot 40,000 strong, but it was really, really an eye-opening experience for me.
Now, have your children read your book?
Oh, yeah. My daughter's 16 and my son's 13 now. And, you know, one of the main threads running through the book is this idea that, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy writing about pot. I want to figure out how to talk with my kids about pot and what to say to them. And I thought at the end of the project, you know, I would have this big lecture with PowerPoint slides and everything, and I'd tell them everything I knew. Well, it didn't work out that way. What happened was something even better, which is that, you know, we started having these small, short conversations about pot because they'd ask me what I was working on that day or who I was interviewing. And I'd say, oh, well, I'm interviewing this guy who's doing some research on, you know, schizophrenia and pot. Here's what they're finding. Here's what they think is going on with the brain and marijuana and all that. And so we would have these short conversations like on the drive to school or at the dinner table. And they wouldn't be heavily lectury. They would just be talking with them about what I'm finding. And, you know, at some points I'd say, look, you're going to encounter pot, you're going to encounter alcohol at a high school party, and you're going to have to, you know, decide for yourself how to handle it. I don't want you taking pot. I don't want you drinking alcohol. But at the same time, we all have to learn to handle ourselves around those substances. It's part of growing up. So it turned out to be one of the best parts of the book. It really surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that a lot of the time with young people, how you deal with things that are both pleasurable and potentially dangerous, like pot or alcohol or sex, if you don't make it a big taboo, then they don't get as, like, weird about it.
That was the key. It was breaking the taboo. You know, at first, I was really nervous about talking with my kids about pot, and I realized after the first couple conversations that just simply broaching the subject, having some knowledge about it, injecting a little humor really went a long way and really opened up not just a conversation about pot, but, you know, conversations about alcohol, about sex, about, you know, about the world that they're entering and becoming more aware of. And one of the funny things that's happening now is other parents are sort of coming up to me and saying, hey, listen, I know you're writing this book about pot. How are you talking to your kids about it? Because they want to know. They want to weigh in. They want a way to break that taboo.
Bruce Barcott is author of the book Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. He's also a longtime contributing editor to Outside Magazine, based right here in Santa Fe. Bruce, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.